shatters into despair, cascading through my veins. This land, with its lithe rivers and fertile forests, has housed and tended to my kin for generations beyond counting. To think of leaving is to abandon the land in which my family has died, to deny my children their rightful legacy. Along the tent roof are shadowy claws of tree branches stripped clean of green stretch. They sway, and the lower branches seethe and scrape loudly at the top of the tent. I belong to this land. My grandmother would tell me stories of family who lived atop the white-capped mountains and in lush valleys below. My grandfather would tell me stories of my people, legends of the great spirits who danced barefoot in the woods and the animals whose kinship runs so deep it is ingrained in every facet of my being. To put aside the land is to put aside the beating, glimmering gift of life that drums inside my breast. To put aside the land is to put aside my right to die upon this land. They can come and burn my tent to the ground, rip my children from me, declaring me unfit to educate, try to purge me from this land, but I belong to this land, wild and untamed as I can only pray it will forever be. I will die on this land.
Listening to Close Reads on CFRC 101.9 FM.
I'm Corey.
And I'm Madeline. On Close Reads, we share and analyze creative writing by students here at Queens. Tune in for Close Reads from close by.
Today, we'll be talking about Put Aside by Kaya Mongren, which you just heard, followed by Indomitable by DJ Shub and Northern Cree. Put Aside was published in the 2023 quilt mini, The Sublime.
I'm going to open by talking about the imagery in the opening two stanzas of the poem. M.H. Abrams' Glossary of Literary Terms describes imagery as all the objects and qualities of sense perception referred to in a poem or other work of literature. So when I refer to imagery, I'm not just talking about visual images, but the various ways this poem employs different senses and modes of perception in relation to place. We first encounter the poem's setting through various different senses. We see and hear the trickles of rain upon the canvas roof. We hear the gentle rappings and the crackle of flames, and we smell the rotting leaves. This threefold description immediately introduces the idea of relating to a space in multiple different modes. There are different ways of relating to the setting, and each of these ways provides a different insight into the qualities of the poem's world. The smell in particular creeps in from the outside, and we see that the larger setting permeates the initial intimate space. The speaker's presence also transcends the canvas boundary, as they are inside, but they see their thermos outside, through the parted canvas. The speaker's presence is evident through their interaction with this environment. The second stanza opens with a new sense, as they feel the cold, and then highlights the cedar tea, supple moose meat, and brown and black fur blankets, providing sustenance and comfort. The poem also highlights the specific provenance of all these objects. It's not just tea, it's cedar tea, and not just meat, but moose meat, which really gives a sense of intimacy to the environment. The speaker is only really represented through their environment. Before we encounter the speaker's body, we've already learned of the blankets upon which they lay. After the poem invites the reader to relate to the setting in various physical ways, it introduces the emotional relationship to the land. I would argue that the emphasis on the relationship as nurturing really frames the land as a relative, anticipating the poem's later exploration of kinship bonds. Imagery becomes inextricable from a sense of relationality. The speaker says, "My grandmother would tell me stories of family who lived atop white-capped mountains and in lush valleys below. My grandfather would tell me stories of my people, legends of the great spirits who dance barefoot in the woods, and the animals whose kinship runs so deep it is ingrained in every facet of my being." The stories and relations with relatives who tell those stories are inextricable from the physical land and its representation. The poem cannot represent the white-capped mountains and lush valleys without also describing the family who lived there. It cannot refer to the woods without the speaker's relations in those woods, relations that go beyond the normative Western understanding of family. Just as the human relations are inextricable from the land, the great spirits and animals present on the land are essential relations. The poem's imagery describes an emotional as well as physical landscape, because that kinship, as the speaker says, is ingrained in every facet of their being. The poem's final mode of relation to the land is one of time. Time is evoked pretty early on by the line, "The reminder of July is gone," but the entire poem is a powerful string of associative reminders of that which is not gone and never will be. The poem's imagery evokes not just the immediate current surroundings of the canvas tent, fire, and rain, but the settings of the speaker's grandparents' stories, because those stories are the context through which the speaker relates to their more immediate space. The poem situates itself in this existing storytelling tradition, and even looks to the future, anticipating children that might someday add a next link to the storytelling chain.
I'm going to focus on the sound effects in this poem, primarily with assonance. We have this in the beginning with rappings and crackle, and then the cold which seeps deeply into the cedar tea in the steel thermos. And as it seeps, we get alliteration with seeps, sinks, cedar, steel, and the supple moose meat on the stove, once again with the brown and black for blankets below the beige in the sky. Again, we get assonance with cascading through my veins, and later the tree branches stripped clean of green, branches that seethe and scrape. These repeated long vowels of E and A slow you down as you read through this, and you can feel the depth of the cold and the power of that cascading despair. The assonance and alliteration then connect across lines of the poem, holding it together and making the poem just very cohesive, but also paralleling these ideas about relationships and interconnectedness in the poem by developing sonic connection and relationships between the words themselves. Similarly, this pairing of sound effects to the poem with the meaning is accomplished through rhythm. This poem makes use of meter incredibly effectively, first briefly with the trochaic gentle rappings paired, giving a rhythm reminiscent of that falling rain. But then, where the rhythm really shines is towards the end, with "to put aside the land is to put aside the beating glimmer gift of life that drums inside my breast. To put aside the land is to put aside my right to die upon this land." We have iambic feet almost the whole way through this section, interrupted in only three places. The first two come after each instance of "to put aside the land." Both times, "is to" makes up two unstressed syllables, breaking up the rhythm enough to create two distinct parts of the line, but not enough to really slow you down as they're unstressed, so the momentum of the iambic pentameter, or iambic meter, rather, in this line is not lost. This creates a division between the cause and effect, and we get a clear pairing, but also a distance, between putting aside the land and what this actually means for the speaker. Especially because the second part of each line is the longer part, this to me puts more weight and importance on the consequences of this action, or rather, the argument for inaction, encouraging the reader to consider what it really means to put aside the land. The third interruption is to me the most powerful, with "my right to die upon this land." When reading this, it is possible to read "my right" as iambic, with the stress on "right," but hearing Kaya read it out loud, it couldn't be clearer that the emphasis is on both of these words. It's not only about her right, it is important that the right is hers. So much of this poem deals with ideas about belonging, the speaker belonging to the land, and here, this right belonging to the speaker. Having two stressed syllables in a row already draws attention to these words, and the fact that they interrupt a long ascension of near-perfect iambic meter furthers this effect. Although the assonance here between "aside my right" and "die" maintain the split's connection to the line, these two words, "my right," are nevertheless singled out. This right really gets us to one of the core themes of this poem, of land sovereignty and again belonging. As the reader or listener, we cannot ignore or put aside the speaker's claim on and connection to the land. In the live reading, these two stressed syllables coincide with the loudest part of the poem, and as Kaya reads this piece very dynamically, the combination of the volume and stress at this part contrasts with the quiet determination of the final stanza. This juxtaposition elevates both the passion of the penultimate stanza and the gravity of the final stanza.
Next, we'll be playing "The Virus" by The Hallucination, featuring Saul Williams and the Chippewa Travelers. Then, we'll be interviewing Kaya about her piece.
The virus took on many shapes: the bear, the elk, the antelope, the elephant, the deer, the mineral, the iron, the copper, the colton, the rubber, the coffee, the cotton, the sugar, the people, the people, the people, the germ traveled faster than the bullet. They harvest the mountainside, protect the crops, herd the cattle. The people, the people, the people, the people, the people. The women and children were separated from the men. They're divided. violence according to the regional filters of their minds. The violence of arrogance crawls into the air, nestles into the geospatial cortex. We are not a conquered people.
All right, we are now here with Kaya, who is the poet behind Put Aside.
Hello.
And we have a few questions for her. So to begin with, when you wrote this, it was your first poem ever. You've obviously come out with a few more great ones since then. But for the first time, how did you start to approach it and what inspired you when writing this?
Yeah, so... Well, it was like I said, like in the question, so helpfully summarized, I had never written a poem before. And I was very nervous writing it. I was really worried that I wasn't going to be able to put down my thoughts in the way that I wanted to. But yeah, it actually is a funny story. So I was sitting in Sterling in between classes for my math class, and I was told that Quilt had extended its submission deadline for the Quilt mini zine. And I was like, this is my sign, because I didn't finish the poem actually before the intended deadline.
I wonder who it was who told you that.
I wonder, honestly.
That's so convenient.
Yeah, so I was sitting in Sterling and I was like, okay, well, I got to get this down on paper, because I hadn't even written anything at that point. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, I got to get it done because submissions are extended. So I basically just sat down on a couch like a couple hours before my lecture, and I just started writing. I had the ideas for Put Aside ever since I was like in middle school. I always enjoyed creative writing. I mean, heck, like I was 9 and I was like, I can write a book. You know, like I was that kid.
Yeah.
But I always didn't know how to tread into poetry. Poetry wasn't kind of like intimidating for me personally. So when coming up with ideas for Put Aside, it was like I gathered little puzzle pieces like over the years of like different inspirations, different imageries that I wanted, and also like vivid imageries of my childhood, like growing up on reserve and camping. My dad is a big camping man, a big bush man. So we'd always go out, and the tents that we were always in were made of canvas with stoves in them to keep us warm in like fall and winter time. So a lot of my inspiration did come from growing up on reserve and really, you know, living with my family and camping and hunting and fishing and trapping. So that's where most of the inspiration came from. Mm-hmm. And it would felt really nice after. Like, I remember sitting in Sterling and be like, wow, I have something that I think is pretty good. So I ended up submitting it that night. And I look back on the first draft of it and I'm like, she's come a long way. But I see that most of the foundations were still there.
So it's a new poem, but a long time coming.
Exactly. Yeah. It's been quite a long time in the making. And I'm very pleased with how Put Aside came out.
Yeah. And what you were saying there like at the end about your family kind of takes us into the next question.
Yeah.
In the poem, there's obviously a major focus on relationships and kinship, both like between the speaker and their grandparents and children, but also with everything that surrounds them, like the sense of the repeated I belong to this land. Can you speak a little bit more about the importance of these relationships and the connections in this piece?
Yeah, for sure. So like I mentioned before, I grew up living on reserve in a small, tiny little reserve called Tamami First Nation. It exists on like an island, basically. It's a semi-remote reserve. You have to get to a boat to cross it and everything. And I grew up around a very loving family. I was very privileged and very lucky to have such a wonderful family who took a lot of pride in our traditions and our knowledge and our history, especially. Tamale First Nation, legally even speaking, has had a history of protesting logging on our traditional homelands. So the importance of the land and taking care of the land was always really spoken to about to me, even when I was younger. Mm-hmm. It's kind of funny because, like, sometimes I wouldn't, like, if I accidentally or, like, if I threw a piece of gum on the ground, my dad would be like, you got to pick that up. And I'm like, okay. And then he'd be like, it's our job to take care of the land, you know, like, he'd, like, pull one of those dad lectures on me. So yeah. I grew up really in touch with that, those ideas of family and kinship being really important. I come from a very large family, 27 great aunts and uncles last I counted. So I have a lot of family members. And it's just always been a really big part of my life and all that sort of thing. And especially the ideas surrounding ancestral territory and ancestral homeland. My dad would constantly talk to me about ancestors, grandmothers and grandfathers that I've had and their stories of living on the lake and living, you know, in tents for most of the year and how they'd hunt and trap. And their trap line was like their lifeline, like they needed that to survive and make money for their family. So I've always been really in touch with this idea of the land is equated to family. And it's like, it's important that you take care of that family and you have to take care of the land. So it was always like spoken about in tandem with each other. So it really placed emphasis for me in this poem that I really wanted to try and get across this understanding that maybe I definitely think the Western point of view really cuts that out, that yeah. part out of it. And it's not talked about as much. It's a different way of approaching land use and land guardianship for sure. So I hope that answers the question.
Absolutely it does. And I think that sense that you were saying of having family and the land in tandem, you absolutely represent in the poem, because we have this like alternation and also connection and overlapping mm-hmm. That you just do so beautifully. Yeah. I think you've touched on this a little bit, but I want to talk explicitly about the titular phrase put aside in the poem. We have it come in briefly early with, I think it's the cedar tea put aside for later. Mm-hmm. But it really comes back at the end with the repeated phrase of to put aside the land. I think the diction here and the repetition are incredibly effective. And I was wondering if you would elaborate on that word choice and just the importance of the phrase here in the poem and the message.
Mm-hmm. So the term, like the phrasing of like put aside, really stuck with me since I was little. I remember asking my father, maybe I was around maybe 6, 7. I asked him like what a reserve was, because I knew we lived on one. I knew that we had less advantages than somebody living off reserve and maybe living in a city. That was just obvious in our day to day life, but I didn't know what that meant. Mm-hmm. To the government and to society at large, I guess, thinking of the hard questions at like 7 years old. But yeah. Anyways, I remember asking him, and he used this very specific phrasing, which my dad always has a disdain when speaking about topics involving government. So yeah. He's always had this like slight twinge of like disgust sometimes I'm talking about the government. And he'd always say, like, it was the crown, in air quotes, putting aside land for indigenous peoples to live on. Mm-hmm. Even though, like, without recognizing that a lot of the families that lived on those areas had areas that they lived on already. Mm-hmm. And my dad always tells me of, originally speaking, we weren't even supposed to be on Bear Island. We were supposed to be on a different island called Tamagami Island. But because the government didn't want us there and there were actually going to be like cottages and cabins there for tourists, we were moved for the second time to Bear Island instead, which is even smaller. So it's like those ideas of putting aside land for use, even though those lands had people living on them who still needed to hunt, fish, and trap to survive, but yeah. You crowd them all on a reserve that's really small. So that phrasing really stuck with me and really popped into my head a lot of the time when writing this poem. And I really tried to make it write it in a way that highlights this very Western point of view of, oh, well, you can just put aside the land. The land will be fine. It'll be developed or it'll be used for other things and it'll be fine. Because there's this idea of land equals property, that yeah. you own it, that is something that can be owned, and that is something that you need to either, like, sometimes it's also of like ideas of exploitation and using the resources of the land to your benefit. And it's, I forget where I was going with that, so like give me a second. But it's not as simple as the simple phrase put aside.
Yeah.
It's not simple enough like that. And to look at that, does the land and the people who live on it a disservice? Especially since an indigenous culture, and what I've always experienced growing up and being in touch with my Anishinaabe roots, was the land is there to take care of you as long as you take care of it. And that kind of reciprocity of being thankful for the land as it has served your ancestors, and thus it will also serve generations after you. There's the idea of making sure that the land is healthy and the land is clean for future generations, because you are not the only one who is going to live on the land. So it really follows like the themes of stewardship and guardianship, and only taking what you need, using everything that you are gifted, and not being wasteful. So it's like, to put that all aside, to just be yeah. like, put that aside, we're going to take the land on you and we're going to put you on a reserve, doesn't make sense in the indigenous perspective, because the land is a part of my family. Like our language wording is very important. And, you know, we call those animals and every living being that lives on Mother Earth, those are our relatives. They also yeah. live here. They also have a place here. So it's like to put that all aside, to be like, to cast that aside as if it means nothing, does a really great disservice to the culture of indigenous peoples. I firmly believe that.
Yeah, and well, you're absolutely right. And I think the way that you really capture that double meaning in the poem is really effective, like putting it aside the way that your father described it being put aside, but also putting it aside as in ignoring it. It really comes through in yeah. the writing and the way you say it. It's just, this is, it's an incredible poem.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you so much for sharing it with us, both when you submitted yes, and today. Mm-hmm. And thank you for coming in and sharing your thoughts.
Yes, of course. Which, thank you for having me here.
Yeah. This has been Put Aside by Kaya Mongrain, which you can read on the Quilt website at queensquilt.ca. This has been Close Reads with Corey and Madeline on CFRC 101.9 FM. To take us out, we will have Indian City by Hallucination and Black Bear. Oh,
Grad Chat is a collaboration between the SGS and CFRC, where we feature one graduate student or postdoc each week, providing them the platform to showcase their research and explain how it affects us. We also occasionally do interviews with postdocs, alumni, or grad students on topical subjects. Are you a grad student, postdoc, or alumni that would like to be interviewed? Visit queensu.ca/sgs/grad-chat to fill out the interviewee form. You can listen to Grad Chat every Tuesday at 4 to 4:30 p.m.
The Sexual Health Resource Center is a confidential, non-judgmental information referral service for all things sex, sexuality, and sexual health. We are located in room 215 of the LaSalle Building at 146 Stewart Street on Queen's University campus. We are open to clients from Queen's, St. Lawrence College, RMC, and the wider Kingston community. We offer sexual health and pleasure products at cost, such as 20-cent condoms and $3 pregnancy tests. Follow us on Instagram at SHRC Kingston for daily hours, center updates, and news about upcoming events.
Visit The Screening Room, Kingston's only independent movie theater located downtown at 120 Princess Street. They specialize in playing art house, international classic, and cult cinema, along with Hollywood's best new releases. People also always say they have the best popcorn in town. Visit Screening Room at screeningroom.com for upcoming show dates and ticket information.
Queen's alumni, homecoming is just a week away. Get ready for a weekend packed with fun, memories, and excitement. Whether you're looking to reconnect, celebrate, or just enjoy the festivities, there's something for everyone. Don't miss out. Find out all the details and plan your perfect weekend at queensu.ca/alumni/homecoming.
A lot of the arguments that were used against gay and lesbian communities in the 50s and 60s are now being recycled against trans people. What I really try to always do in my shows is ask audiences, why am I only safe when I'm entertaining you? Why can't I look like this just next to you on the subway or walking down the street? Why do you see this as a costume and not what you're wearing as a costume? It's an attempt and a desire to disappear us so we can maintain the myth that there are just two genders, man and woman.
This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Thai King gives royal assent to marriage equality. Russian lawmakers ban adoptions to pro-queer countries. And a look challenges the gender masquerade. Those stories and more this week because you've unmasked This Way Out.
I'm David Hunt.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending September 28th, 2024. Marriage in Thailand will now be defined as a legal union of two individuals. King Maha Vajiralongkorn made it official on September 24th with his royal assent to a bill amending the country's civil and commercial code. It won approval in the Senate in June by a lopsided vote of 130 to 4. The previous definition of civil marriage referred to the parties as a man and a woman, or a husband and wife. Adoption and inheritance rights are included in the legislation. It takes effect 120 days from the king's signature and the publication of his assent in the Royal Gazette. Thailand is now the first Southeast Asian country to achieve marriage equality. Despite its global reputation for being queer-friendly, the struggle has been arduous. Activist Siritata Ninlaprook told Agence France-Presse, "We've been fighting for our rights for over 10 years, and now it's finally happening." Same-gender couples will be able to walk down the aisle for the first time on January 22, 2025. Bangkok Pride is organizing a mass wedding ceremony for queer couples on the big day.
The Duma has given initial approval to a ban on the adoption of Russian children to countries where gender-affirming healthcare is practiced. Speaker Vyacheslav Volodin proclaimed, We are doing everything for the child not to end up in a country where same-sex marriage and sex change is allowed. The measure bars adoptive parents from countries that approve the change of sex by medical intervention, including with the use of medicine. Countries that allow trans people to change their legal gender on government documents are also prohibited. The vote in the first reading was 397-1. Two more readings and passage by the upper house of Russia's legislature are required before Vladimir Putin can sign it into law. His war on Ukraine has complicated the adoption process by making it close to impossible for prospective foreign parents to travel to Russia. Putin might also want to deflect attention from the thousands of Ukrainian children that have been illegally siphoned into Russian foster care.
Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is on the warpath against another Biden administration queer-supportive policy. This time, the far-right Republican is suing over a requirement that foster care agencies equip prospective families to support a child's potential LGBTQ plus identity. The Department of Health and Human Services guidelines were issued on April 30th and took effect on July 1st. They flatly state all foster care placements must be safe and appropriate for all children, including LGBTQI plus children. The guidelines also protect children from being forcibly outed to prospective parents or staff at foster care agencies. The infamously anti-queer Paxton is arguing that the guidelines unconstitutionally violate his state's sovereignty. Texas bans pediatric gender-affirming health care and has other repressive anti-trans laws. Paxton also complains that the additional costs of compliance threaten substantial economic injury to Texas. He's asking the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Texas for a permanent injunction against implementation of the guidelines and for monetary damages.
A leading free expression advocate reports this week that more than 10,000 books were banned in U.S. public schools during the 2023-2024 academic year. That's more than triple the nearly 3,400 books PEN America said were removed from public school libraries during the previous academic year. The group released its initial results on September 23rd to kick off Banned Books Week. PEN America specifically blames bans passed in Republican-controlled state legislatures like Iowa, Florida, Utah, South Carolina, and Tennessee under the guise of parental rights. In the words of their press release, the stark increase includes books featuring romance, books about women's sexual experiences, and books about rape or sexual abuse, as well as continued attacks on books with LGBTQ plus characters or themes, or books about race or racism and featuring characters of color. The book banning fever is starting to engulf some surprising mainstream titles, along with the usual queer-related suspects like Alice Walker's The Color Purple, Mike Curato's Flamer, and Justin Richardson, Peter Parnell, and Henry Cole's And Tango Makes Three. Students are no longer supposed to study Alex Haley's seminal Roots, the saga of an American family. Agatha Christie's Death on the Nile has been thrown overboard, along with Terry McMillan's How Stella Got Her Groove Back. For some reason, it took the censors until this round to catch iconic queer black writer James Baldwin's semi-autobiographical Go Tell It on the Mountain. PEN America promises that a final count and a more detailed analysis into the rationales behind particular objections is forthcoming. The PEN America release concludes, book bans impede the freedom to read, limiting students' access to diversity of views and stories.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation's annual Crime in the Nation report reveals a major increase in hate crimes in the United States in 2023. Particularly those targeting LGBTQ plus people. More than 1 in 5 hate crimes were motivated by anti-queer animus. This week's report counts more than 2,400 hate incidents based on sexual orientation. That's an increase of more than 500 cases over the previous year. More than 400 incidents were based on gender identity or expression, and an additional 146 incidents targeted gender nonconforming people. Keep in mind that far more anti-queer hate crimes go unreported. The rise in hate crimes runs counter to a significant drop in crime overall during the presidency of Joe Biden. The Human Rights Campaign contributed research to the report. The queer advocacy group pointed to the disproportionate number of hate crimes targeting transgender women of color, especially Black people and immigrants. HRC officially declared a state of emergency for the queer community last year. In a statement released this week, President Kelly Robinson challenged government officials to, in her words, stop lying about our community and inciting hatred against us, and called for comprehensive anti-bias protections. To PFLAG's Brian K. Bond, the FBI report was abysmal. The Queer Ally Group's CEO said, "Our LGBTQ plus loved ones need both our compassion and our action to make our community safe and our laws inclusive, so every LGBTQ plus person can be safe, celebrated, affirmed, and loved everywhere in the U.S.
Finally, a study published this week in the scientific journal Nature Human Behavior is no surprise. In the words of Vice President of Research Renita Naff of the Youth Suicide Prevention Group, the Trevor Project, it offers robust and indisputable evidence to support what we have already known. The recent wave of anti-transgender laws in the United States is quite literally risking the lives of young people across the country. The report is based on new peer-reviewed research by the Trevor Project. It tracked self-reported suicide attempts by young people from 13 to 17 years of age across multiple years. The rate of attempted suicide increased by up to 72% following the passage of an anti-trans law in a respondent's home state. Bullying also played a role in those attempted suicides, which also led to increased substance abuse and missed school days. State laws weighing on trans youth include school sports bans, campus bathroom and changing room requirements, and severe restrictions or total prohibitions on pediatric gender-affirming health care. Trevor Project CEO James Black's press statement reads in part, "As we get closer to critical elections this November, these young people will continue to be reduced to political talking points. I urge every adult, no matter your political beliefs, to remember that transgender and non-binary young people are our family, our friends, and our neighbors. It's not necessary to fully understand their experience to acknowledge that they, like all young people, deserve dignity, respect, and the ability to lead healthy and full lives."
That's News Wrap, Global Queer News with Attitude, for the week ending September 28th, 2024. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian Schaefer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt. Stay healthy.
And I'm Michael LeBeau. Stay safe.
Hi, this is John Cameron Mitchell, the writer-director of Hedwig the Angry Inch and Short Bus, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international weekly radio magazine for all our sexually diverse communities.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Smashing the gender binary is a revolutionary act that opens up a whole new perspective on liberation politics. This Way Out's Brian DeShazer picked up on the fact that that new train of thought is rich with the echoes of a forward-thinking queer philosopher activist of the 1990s.
A few years ago, I watched an episode of Getting Curious with Jonathan Van Ness on Netflix and discovered the charismatic Alok. an incredible non-binary, gender non-conforming artist. I was instantly captivated and have followed their journey ever since. Earlier this year, I learned that Alok is the nibbling of LGBT activist Urvashi Vaid, a frequent guest on This Way Out back in the 1990s. I sent Alok some classic recordings and invited them to join us on the show. That invitation led to an incredible conversation this past July. For those who don't know, Alok, they, them, is an internationally acclaimed poet, comedian, speaker, and actor. They've published works like Beyond the Gender Binary and Femme in Public, and have performed in over 40 countries, including shows at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival and the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. Alok's work offers an accessible introduction to gender fluidity, showing us how moving beyond the binary creates freedom for everyone. Next, we talk about their book, Beyond the Gender Binary, which challenges the world to see gender not in black and white, but in full color. Taking from their own experiences as gender non-conforming artists, they show us that gender is a malleable and creative form of expression.
What I found is that the majority of people support trans rights. They just don't have the arguments on why. And so I wanted to create a really accessible handbook that people could consult with the sort of leading debates around trans issues and trans rights and potential rebuttals. So what we're seeing, unfortunately, across the world is, as we've seen progress for gay, lesbian, and bi rights, there's been a backlash taken out in the form of specifically trans rights. And a lot of the arguments that were used against gay and lesbian communities in the 50s and 60s are now being recycled and reworkshopped to be deputized against trans people. So in the handbook, I sort of offer some of the common arguments that are used against us and what we could say back.
Right. So that first one, and actually in the beginning, you really talk about beauty and fear and your experience just being you. And how does that empower you?
It's quite ridiculous because there's a way in which conservative forces have made people feel like trans people have access to some kind of mythological power or cultural influence, when many of us actually can't leave our homes without very real risk of physical violence and intense persecution. There are very few places in the world that I can safely express myself, and I'm constantly having to navigate physical safety even in 2024. And what I notice, and a lot of what inspired me to write that book, is that it's often the days that I am most myself that I'm most in danger. And so there's a way in which we tell people to be themselves, but we don't actually create the mechanisms to protect them when they are. And that we live in a country and a culture that punishes people for their authentic self-expression. So what that looks like for me is, if I decide to wear a dress or if I decide to wear makeup or things that are associated with femininity that people see as dissonant or incongruent with my quote-unquote masculine body, then people feel threatened or intimidated by that. And violence becomes a corrective where they're trying to intimidate me into being back into the binary. So what I read a lot of the harassment against gender nonconforming people as is an attempt and a desire to disappear us so we can maintain the myth that there are just two genders, man and woman.
And what is that like? You know, that book was written 4 years ago, and now you've traveled, let's just say, 20 cities so far in your world tour. How does that affect you now in terms of that the safe place when you are traveling internationally? How has that changed for you from 2020 when you wrote the book till now, or has it?
You know, I think what's hard is that a lot of people consume queer people's content, like we're fabulous and spectacular, and we are, but we're also in danger. So what's important to name is I can sell at a venue and then be called a faggot on the street right after. That happened to me twice on this most recent tour. And when we think about like our favorite pop divas, if that was happening to white, cisgender, straight women, we would think that's a real issue. That's a crisis. How dare you? But we've become so accustomed and normalized to the routine homophobia and transphobia that we're only acceptable with queer expression when it's on a stage. And even that's coming under attack with these recent anti-drag laws, which are also trying to criminalize gender nonconformity in a performance context. So what I really try to always do in my shows is ask audiences, why am I only safe when I'm entertaining you? Why can't I look like this just next to you on the subway or walking down the street? Why do you see this as a costume and not what you're wearing as a costume? If you're going to say that I'm masquerading as something, so too are you. Yeah, you know, often we hear, you're valid, but I can't remember your pronouns. That's too complicated. Or your preferred name is too much, too hard for me to recall. I see you as what I named you when you were born. And people's discomfort is taken as equivalent to oppression. And so what that's resulted in is profound suicidality, depression, mental illness, and many LGBT and especially trans and gender nonconforming communities, because we're constantly made to feel like our very existence is an inconvenience. And what I've always believed is that we put in the time for the things that we care about. So people use this idea of comprehension, I don't get it, or it's too complex, as a shield to not name a deeper truth, which is, I don't care. And I think that's what we receive on the other side, is when people say things to us like, this is too much, what we read is, you just don't care because you put in the time to learn the things that you care about. You know about all the different kinds of cars. You know about the differences between different vacuum cleaners. You find things that you're passionate about, and then you get curious about them. But when it comes to trans and gender nonconforming people, you think that, that we're just some sort of self-indulgent, attention-seeking, wanting to be oppressed phenomenon. What I really want people to understand is that that's a manufactured narrative that's been created specifically as part of sanctioning discrimination against us. So while most people think that we're crybabies, murder, violence, homelessness, criminalization against our communities is escalating. So one of the things I was thinking about, especially in preparing for this conversation and listening to some of the recordings of my late aunt Rishi Vad, is she spoke a lot about this concept, virtual equality, which is one of the books that she wrote. And part of, I think, the new tendril of virtual equality is also virtual acceptance. There's been a mirage of, oh, we're an LGBTQ progressive society, but that's just a narrative or a discourse that hasn't actually mapped into the lived experiences of LGBTQ people. We still don't have domestic violence shelters that are attuned to the specifics of our relationship configurations. We have no plans for our LGBTQ elders. We're often dealing with extreme poverty and alienation. There's so much infrastructure we haven't built, and yet people think that we're equal.
Visibility is the key to success of the lesbian and gay movements for civil rights protections. Hi, I'm Urvashi Vaid, inviting you to listen to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine, one of our most visible and articulate voices for our lesbian and gay communities.
That was Urvashi Vaid, a look's aunt. Next, we will play a clip of Urvashi from 1995, interviewed by Josie Cotoggio for This Way Out. Lucia Chappell gives the introduction.
Former executive director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, Urvashi Vaid, has just come out with a new book. Virtual Equality, the Mainstreaming of Gay and Lesbian Liberation, examines how the strategies of the movement have brought us so far in some ways and yet gained us so little in others. At the same time I was doing all this work, I was, you know, getting more and more involved in gay and lesbian organizations. And I brought this intellectual and kind of political commitment to social change and social justice into my movement work. The thing is that the gay movement has always been... yeah, I don't know. I guess we've been split, or there's a tension in the movement between folks who see the role of a gay movement as in a narrow, narrow sense, and those of us who come from many other movements for social change and see that the gay movement has to be part of a broader process of changing society to make it more democratic for all people.
Well, that was Urvashi Vaid from an interview from November 20th, 1995 on This Way Out. And yeah, it doesn't seem like much has changed, has it?
No, unfortunately. I was thinking the same thing while I was listening to her recordings. Her words are oddly prophetic to describe our current condition.
And also, yeah, when I think about what they must have been talking about in terms of who the people were in Congress, the cast has changed, and yet we're still talking about the same actions against us, you know, anti-trans, anti-queer, more so than ever before, even. As you've been traveling the world, what has been the international response or feedback that you've gotten about the American paradigm right now?
There's been a profound reconciliation where people are now seeing that the U.S. has been a really great broadcasting and marketing project, saying that it's this LGBTQ safe haven, and people are waking up to that collective spell that it's not. There's a lot of conversations of like, Tennessee, are you kidding me? Florida, what's going on? People are profoundly alarmed and disenchanted and disillusioned with the United States. There's also a frustration because a lot of the techniques and strategies of the anti-LGBTQ movement in the US are being globalized and disseminated across the world right now. So a key staple in these far-right and authoritarian regimes is anti-LGBTQ politics. And that playbook is being created in places like Florida and then disseminated across the world. So these people don't see the US as something over there, woe is me. They're also paying attention because they're seeing the exact same rhetoric. I was recently on a call with some trans activists from Pakistan, and they were telling me that in their Supreme Court rulings, a lot of the conservative forces there are citing U.S. policymakers and U.S. cultural makers around anti-transness. And when they say, hey, actually, we have documentation of thousands of years of history of gender fluidity within the Pakistani context, that doesn't matter, because now what's happening is this idea that being trans or non-binary is this newfangled millennial internet phenomenon, which is once again a manufactured narrative. That's becoming the predominant narrative globally.
Wow. So disheartening, and yet I'm still so enlivened by what the movement may be or what it can be. I just hope that there's a quicker response. Another thing I was thinking too is like, you know, for decades, it was always about people coming from other countries to America for safe haven, whether Nigeria, Ugandans, people where there's countries that are seriously in danger. I mean, immigrating into America. Now I feel like I need a place to go if the tables turn.
I think you're totally right. And I feel frustrated because especially revisiting these interviews with Orvish from 20, 30, 40 years ago, what she was really clearly arguing is that the more progressive wing of the LGBTQ movement was fighting for total and fundamental freedom. And because decisions were made not for the progressive wing of the movement to be the predominant strain, that's why we're in this situation. We're in this situation precisely because of our assimilationist bent in our movement that said, we're just like you, that said, we're not trying to ruffle any feathers. That's how we got to this situation where we can see the exact same rhetoric that was used against our communities 70 years ago have so much traction and pull. So because we moved from a place of fear and inadequacy, a place of pick me, that's where partially why we're in this situation now. And I feel like so often the work of lesbians, of trans people, of people of color gets dismissed as minoritarian, as of like full of fractions or divisive. But actually these frameworks create more total and fundamental freedom for an entire society. Had the queer movement actually continued to seek alliances with broader movements for social and economic progress and change, we would have built the coalitions that could actually sustain the kind of safety that we're looking for now. But instead, a decision to splinter off into really myopic issues, like just focusing on marriage at the expense of poverty, or focusing on gay adoption rights at the expense of overhauling our entire education system. These more fundamental and total politics that I think Orvishi was so interested in.
You've been listening to part one of our inspiring conversation with the incredible Aluk Dad Menem. Please join us next week for the conclusion of our conversation with more historic audio of Orvishi Vad. For This Way Out, I'm Brian DeShazer.
Thanks for finding This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by David Hunt and Michael LeBeau. News Wrap and this week's feature were produced by Brian DeShazer with the assistance of Daniel Luisius. You heard music by James Cameron Mitchell, Tom Petty, and Julian Winter. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks to the Ivana Foundation and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on WDRT, Viroqua, Wisconsin, 5GTR, Mount Gambier, South Australia, KPCA, Petaluma, California, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.
From the New York Underground to Kingston's Grand Theater, Grand On Stage presents the Hot Sardines.
By me, Mr. Shane. Please let me explain.
Performing songs from their latest album, C'est la Vie, a bilingual blend of original jazz songs and timeless standards. The Hot Sardines, Friday, October 4th at Kingston Grand Theater. Tickets for The Hot Sardines and the rest of the Grand On Stage season are on sale now at kingstongrand.ca.
Homecoming isn't just for alumni, it's for the whole Kingston community. Join us Saturday, October 20th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for the Fall Harvest Gathering at Agnes Benedictson Field. Enjoy live music, face painting, lawn games, and the flavors of Kingston's finest food trucks. Plus, explore a pop-up vendor market featuring local artisans. This free outdoor event celebrates the season and brings together friends, family, and community. Visit queensu.ca/alumni/homecoming for more. Hello, lovely listeners, and welcome to Busy Girl Radio here on CFRC 101.9 FM. I'm your host, Lily, and I'm so excited to be back in the recording studio. For those of you who do not know me, I'm a fourth-year student here at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, and I've been involved with the radio for a year now. Actually, this is my year anniversary, but I don't even know if you could count that because I left last semester to go study in Western Australia for my exchange, and I had the best time, and I actually worked for our campus, like the host school that I was at, their campus and community radio station called UW Radio. And I filmed a bunch of TikToks and Instagram reels where I went up to people on campus asking what music they were listening to, which was lots of fun. I went to some events with them for some student surf rock Australian bands, which was very cool. But boy, oh boy, am I excited to be back here in my home studio at CFRC. So I think I am going to play my first song for you guys. And I have to be completely honest, I'm a bit intimidated being back here. Obviously, the technology aspect of things is a little bit rusty, and I have been pushing off this radio show. Every week I send an email and I'm saying, okay, I'll start it next week.